Sunday, April 15th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents guitarist, composer, Nels Klein. Join us as we find out that there's more to Nels Klein than Wilco and his latest Nels Klein 4 release. That's Sunday, April 15th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is guitarist and composer Nels Klein. Nels Klein is going to be at Le Poisson Rouge with his group Nels Klein 4 tomorrow evening, and we'll be talking more about that during the course of this program. The Nels Klein 4 have a new release, Currents Constellations. In recognition of National Poetry Month, we're going to start off the program with Cecil Taylor reading 336. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some sugar. Darkness, a movable, a scream.
Children of
hell. Voices in purple.
Red light.
Voices.
The red light.
Enter slow-footed like.
Hues of the sky.
Pigeon, stone, riding crow.
Right.
Still whiter. Still whiter snake. I am
love.
I am love. I am love. To have you dressed opposite, caused by a silent vertical. Water and sacred hills.
Have ten.
Rise and rise and
roar.
Slow-footed today.
Hell or hell.
Enter. There.
Hell or hell.
They pause. Silence. And
On, gone, on, gone, gone. Magnetized. They have been concretized, inexpressive.
Never under.
Having two colors, origins, horizons. Lower bottom and red lower crown offered by the vigilant. In far seas, one is contained in rivers.
On hills.
It's upon dual seas.
We may as and through blood cosmic enter the womb. Enter the womb. Enter the womb. And pause.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones. I'm on the line with...
Nels Klein.
Nels Klein, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Hi, Joyce. How are you?
I'm okay. I really appreciate the time you're going to spend with us. There's so much I want to talk about, but I want to start right here at the beginning of your music and get this out of the way. Your brother.
Okay.
Your brother Alex.
Yes.
You started playing with him, right?
Yes, I did. Well, he started a little ahead of me, but started around age 12, playing rock and roll, sort of.
Now, there's a particular special type of twin the two of you are.
Yes, that's right. Could yeah, you? We're mirror twins. It's a type of identical twin. And I'm told, I don't know if it's true because I've never actually looked this up, but I'm told that it's a type of twin wherein the egg in the mother's womb splits at a very late stage. So mirror twins are odd because we're basically opposites. And if you look at the back of one's head while he's looking in the mirror, he looks like the other one. So in this case, Alex is right-handed, I'm left-handed, our hair naturally parts on opposite sides, and to some extent, we have rather opposite personalities as well, in that Alex is really a rather serious and disciplined individual as opposed to his brother. I'm a little more gregarious and certainly not disciplined.
I understand that your clothing styles are opposite as well. You're more, I don't know, GQ?
Well, I mean, I'm not averse to a little fashion now and again, but I'm pretty boring these days compared to my 90s looks. But yeah, Alex is vegan and wears a lot of hemp.
But you still play together, which I've noticed on some recordings.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's more difficult than it used to be because I'm in New York and he's in Los Angeles. But he's getting out a little bit more that his daughter's growing up. So he's done all the concerts of the Lovers record, my double record from almost 2 years ago now.
Right.
He's the only person I wanted to play that music. And certainly he's a great percussionist and a really interesting and powerful composer as well.
I know in the beginning, the recordings that you did together, the music was sort of, well, it sounded to me anyway, and it's the type I like, jazz fusion, as it was called.
That's right.
And
a type of jazz fusion, certainly. I mean, we kind of started at the very beginning of that sound, listening to that music. So certainly Electric Miles Davis and Early Weather Report and Herbie Hancock Septet and Tony Williams Lifetime and Mahavishnu Vishnu Orchestra and the like were very important to us. Also, Miles' earlier acoustic quintet before Miles in the Sky and those records, like Feed the Kilimanjaro, those are important as well. And the group Oregon, which I guess you'd call a fusion band because they fuse so many different styles and musics, very important as well.
I love that kind of thing, actually, got to tell you. As a matter of fact, I understand
good.
On your recent release, the Nels Klein 4, there was a recording that you were actually going to call fusion.
Oh, yes. There's a song on there that I ended up titling Imperfect 10.
Thank you.
which is kind of a Schofield-y kind of groover, and my provisional title was Jazz Fusion Composition.
Right.
I think Scott Colley and maybe even Tom Rainey, the Stentorian Rhythm Section in the NC4, are maybe a little disappointed that I ended up giving it another title.
Right.
But, you know, even in the 90s, when pretty much the worst thing you could do was say I'm a fusion fan or a fusion musician to a bunch of cool indie rockers or whatever, I like using the F word to just upset people. And it's not so upsetting now, you know. I mean, basically, it seems like anything that's cool is eventually uncool, and then everything that's uncool is eventually cool if you live long enough. When Alex and I were in high school, starting out high school, and we started getting interested in Coltrane and Miles and everything from the aforementioned sort of jazz rock or electric jazz, later term fusion bands, and also groups like the Art Ensemble of Chicago and New Dalta Acri with Otto Leo Smith's music, we didn't really think about these kinds of labels so much. And then fusion, it seems like it's just a catch-all phrase because it can mean anything from Return to Forever Romantic Warriors sort of symphonic chops music, or it could be Grover Washington Jr., Mr. Magic or something. You know, it kind of just all got tossed in the same bin in the 70s.
Right.
Of kind of music with a contemporary flavor that you could either listen to or ignore, that had a groove or didn't have a groove, or it had some kind of contemporary, maybe instrumental component like a Fender Rhodes electric piano. But essentially, what does fusion mean? I guess it means that you can just take on aspects of different styles and different disciplines and combine them.
Right.
Which is definitely where I'm coming from, having not really grown up with much of a tradition musically other than, I guess, the blues aspect of rock music, which was very prevalent in the late 60s when I started listening. Fortunately for me, I've never been concerned with what is or isn't jazz, except when confronted with playing a standard or something, in which case I wish I'd studied a little more carefully. All these terms that we toss around like ragtime and New Orleans jazz and all these different aspects of, I guess, what was once popular music based on blues, which is kind of more what people to get through their lives, you know, in an oral tradition. You know, I just came out of listening to the radio and listening to records. And obviously we're looking at, in my case, decades of global communication and awareness of other cultures, which didn't exist as readily, except I guess if you were a merchant marine or something, you got around as my late uncle did and saw a lot of different places because he was on a ship. But everybody else had to just read about these things. Well, then we got television and radio and all these things that made us closer.
Right.
And it was really Indian classical music that was my first inspiration to think about playing music when I was about 10 years old, when I heard Ravi Shankar.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, psychedelia happened and all this wondrous sonic experimentation in popular music that was about mind expansion and elements of color and creativity and vivid excitement in sound, not just in songcraft. And that's kind of where I come from. And then later, I guess I got serious about harmony from listening to orchestral music, such as that of Maurice Ravel or Béla Bartók, and also what we like to call jazz, which has phenomenal harmonic invention and wonderful sounds thereof, you know. So I just wanted to know more about what these cool chords and chord progressions are. And that's not much of a tradition on my part, but that's just where my curiosity led me. But I never became a real jazz person. That's a calling that's ultra serious and takes an amazing amount of discipline and concentration. And now it's very much bolstered by the educational institutions that we have. And that was not really the case when I was trying to learn about this kind of stuff back in the early 70s.
Thank you.
There's a jazz umbrella in my thinking, and many things have fallen under it. And I've talked to musicians, and they tend to feel ambivalent about embracing that aesthetic. Okay, I am a jazz musician. Because they think of, you know, it's something else. If they have the desire to embrace that aesthetic, I think they're a jazz musician. If they actually follow the principles.
I'm certainly not ambivalent, but out of deep respect for those who commit to the level of somebody, like I just finished Fred Hirsch's memoir, Good Things Happen Slowly, and he's a real jazz musician, and I love reading about his discovery of the music and his really deep search and profound level of discipline and training.
I see.
And I don't possess that. I just try to stay respectful and keep my mouth shut the rest of the time. I don't know.
Got it. Well, you know, my introduction to your music, from what I'm reading anyway, let me start there. From what I've been reading to prepare for this exchange, a lot of people seem to know of you via Wilco.
Yeah, that happened for sure. I was almost 50 when I joined Wilco. Yeah, I mean, I've been in the band 14 years.
Wow.
And it definitely made me visible to an audience that, for the most part, I think, had never heard of me, but an audience that's basically open-minded and much larger than the audience that I was playing to before.
Yes.
Certainly.
slice of hearts with my own hands. Almost.
So what has that done for you as the artist that you were and the artist that you are now?
Well, it's revolutionized my life, to be honest, Joyce. It's utterly profound in that playing in the group itself is incredibly fun, and we really like to play at our highest level every night and without drama and with pure commitment, and it's not super heavy. We like to have a good time besides play serious and sad material once in a while. A lot of Jeff Tweedy songs are kind of depressing, which I love. But we like to rock out, and I like to rock out. But on another level, two things. One is that it allows me a certain amount of freedom, not only within the musical context of Wilco, but also the management helps me do my music. So that's amazing. But the other thing is that with the expanded awareness of yours truly from doing concerts, the size, I guess you will say, of Wilco shows, and with the dedication and loyalty that their audience has, I can actually go play my music even at its most avant-garde or experimental or extemporaneous, and about twice as many people show up now as would have pre-Wilco.
Yippee!
Which is a huge thing when you're playing in a small club in, say, Indianapolis, and pre-Wilco would have been 40 people and then post is 80. That's a big difference.
Oh, yeah.
It feels a lot different, and it's helpful. And I don't know if these people all like the various iterations of my own personal musical expression, but they're supportive and curious, so they come out, and that's a huge change.
So tell me about what you call the NC4, Nels Klein 4. How did it come about?
Well, I started playing with Mr. Julian Lage as a duo after meeting him at a lunch. We used to have these lunches when I was living in the West Village at the end of my street for Jim Hall. Jim's good friend, Brian Camilio, and now a good friend of mine, invited me to these lunches that he would throw for Jim to get him out of his apartment, and so he'd stay in touch with his friends, and it was his musician friends. I was very self-conscious and flattered to be included at first, but it became kind of really relaxed, and finally this guy that kept talking about Julian showed up, and we really hit it off and started improvising together almost immediately. Since I lived about three quarters of a block away from where we were eating, he came over, and I really cherished this duo, but we sort of fantasized every once in a while as to what the music would be like if we added a rhythm section, and I finally decided to see what that would be like by putting this group together about 2.5 years ago, maybe, during a week residency that I was doing at The Stone in the East Village, John Zorn's space that he was doing on Avenue C, 2nd Street. So we just had about a 20-minute blow through some heads before we hit it, and then the audience came in and we played, and it felt really good. So I just decided to see if I wrote some more music for this group, if we could make a go of it. And so we have a record out, or it's about to come out, and I'm just trying to do some gigs with the busiest individuals on the planet. So I think concerts with this band may be a rare event, but I think I kind of knew that going into this. But we're going to try to keep doing it, and certainly Julie and I are dedicated to continuing our duo as well, which is truly, for me, one of the most important and profound things I've been able to participate in musically in my life.
Well, I would like to thank Julian Lage officially for getting us together. He passed on your information.
Yes, well, yes, thanks, Julian. He's a remarkable dude.
Thank you.
The name of the release is Currents, Constellations. That's your second release on Blue Note.
Yeah.
And Lovers was the first, right?
It was. It's an odd situation. I mean, basically, Blue Note has licensed these records from my nascent label that never put out anything but a DVD.
Oh.
I put out a DVD of me and my painter friend, Norton Wisdom, our duo called Stained Radiance, many years ago that no one bought, and I had an imprint. And Lovers was going to be self-released until Rachel Jones and Don Was at Blue Note ended up hearing it kind of in the 11th hour. We'd already done the cover, and it was mixed and mastered, and they said, no, we want to put this out. So everything changed. And that's kind of what happened in a way with this NC4 release, which is I just started recording just for the heck of it. And then I played a few tracks for Don Was, and he said, I love this record. Let's do it. So we do another one. And I guess that's how it's going to go. Play a few tracks and see if we have another one coming out someday. But in the meantime, it's really just flattering and impressive and weirdly kind of iconic to be doing anything with Blue Note for me. So I'm kind of amazed.
Yay.
Certainly made the awareness of Lovers vaster than it would have been if I'd put it out myself.
Sure. It was also a two CD set.
Yeah, it was hefty. I mean, they knew what they were getting into. It's long. It was never intended to be as long as it came out in my earliest days of thinking about the Lovers project, which started about sometime in the late 80s, probably. I started pondering this idea. But the song list kept expanding over the years, and it was actually my good friend and producer of that record and some others of mine, David Breskin, and my arranger conductor, Dr. Pal Michael Leonard, who they both said, hey man, let's just record all the stuff you want to do and see what happens. And it actually ended up being kind of almost a narrative. And for me, then it's ultimately then not too long because I'll never be able to do anything like that again anyway. So I might as well, I guess, just cram it all in there. Brevity's never been my strength anyway.
Yeah.
Seriously. Although this new NC4 record had to be vinyl length and I was forced to be brief.
Wow.
It was a really good exercise.
So how was it for
you?
So
that's, well, I think that it came at the right time. I think I would have been strangely irritated had this happened 15 years ago and I had to make a 42-minute record. Now I wish that all my older records are 42 minutes. Some of them are so long, I can't even believe. I just wonder, what was I thinking? Self-editing is obviously not a strength in my case. But the old dog can learn a few new tricks. Certainly, I go back to the vinyl days, but I think we always used to chafe a little bit about the limitations of vinyl, not only in terms of sheer length and the dynamic aspects of mastering vinyl, where you know you have to try to not have loud program material at the end of the side and all that stuff. But we used to sometimes just not want to stop and turn the record over if you're listening to a symphony or something. It was
That's very limiting.
I kind of like all formats. I just find something to like about them and something to hate about them. It's just the way it goes.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is guitarist, composer Nels Cline. What you're listening to in the background is from Nels Cline's 2016 release on Blue Note Records, Lovers. This is It Only Has to Happen Once. The personnel is huge, but it includes Nels Cline on guitar, Michael Leonard, who's the arranger and conductor, Alex Cline on drums and percussion, Julian Lage on acoustic guitar and electric guitar. Before that, we heard from the Nels Cline 4, Nels Cline's current release, Currents, Constellations. The selection is called Temporarily. It will be released soon on Blue Note Records. Nels Cline on acoustic guitar and electric guitar, Julian Lage on electric guitar, Scott Coley on acoustic bass, and Tom Rainey on drums. Before that, we heard from Wilco, Art of Almost, from their 2011 The Whole Love release on DBPM Records. Nels Cline on electric guitar and loops, Jeff Tweedy on vocals and acoustic guitar, John Styrett on bass, Patrick Sansone on mellotron, acoustic guitar, electric guitar, and tambourine, Mikhail Jorgensen on synthesizer, keyboards, and programming, and Glenn Kutch on drums and percussion. Before that, we heard House of Foil from Quartet Music and their release Summer Night. That's a 1989 Delos Records release. Nels Cline on acoustic guitar, Eric Von Essen on double bass and piano, Tim Byrne on alto saxophone, Jeff Gauthier on violin, and Alex Cline on drums and percussion. Before that, we heard another selection from the Nels Cline 4 Currents Constellations. Imperfect 10 is the name of that selection. Before that, we heard Maria Alone from Nels Cline and his 1988 Enja Records release Angelica, Eric Von Essen on bass and harmonica, Tim Byrne on alto saxophone, Stacy Rouse on trumpet and flugelhorn, Alex Cline on drums and percussion. And of course, Nels Cline is the producer, acoustic guitarist, and electric guitarist. Before that, we heard Cecil Taylor from Chinampas Hot Points. The selection was 336, which is actually the length of the selection. Cecil Taylor is the poet, his voice. He's also playing timpani, bells, and small percussion. Of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This is an RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. This is a 1998 compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams and more from Sugar in My Bowl and Nels Cline right here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for April 15th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar My Bowl guests, so you can see them live. And this week's guest is guitarist Nels Cline. You can see him leading the Nels Cline 4 at Les Poissons Rouges on April 16th, and guitarist Julian Lage will be with him for that performance as well. And we have more listings for you this week. We start with bassist Ron Carter, who's at the Jazz Standard on the 17th, with Ethan Iverson trio. Saxophonist Billy Harper also joins Ethan Iverson at the Jazz Standard on the 17th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on the 18th and is at Smoke with Avery Sharp's trio on the 26th. Saxophonist Pharoah Sanders is at Les Poissons Rouges on the 19th. Bassist Christian McBride leads a big band at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from the 19th to the 22nd. Bassist Linda Mahon O is at the Village Vanguard from the 19th through the 22nd. Saxophonist Kenny Garrett is at the Blue Note from the 19th to the 22nd. pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions returns for late night sets at Smoke on the 20th and 27th. Looking a little further ahead, guitarist Mary Halverson is at the Jazz Gallery on the 24th with Ingrid Laubrock's Anti-House 4. Trombonist Steve Turay and harpist Brandy Younger are at Newark's New Jersey Performing Arts Center for a celebration of Dorothon Kirk on the 28th. Finally, blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is at Iridium on May 2nd and at Piermont's Turning Point Cafe on May 4th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The Support WBAI link on the Sugar in My Bowl website has details, and we'll be grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and are scheduled to be back on air on Sunday, April 29th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Well, you know, you mentioned your duet Room with Julian Lage. Mm-hmm. You brought one of the selections from Room onto the NC4 release, Aminette.
Yes, yeah, just an excuse to jam.
Yeah.
You know, just a line. title comes from the combination of the names of Scott Amendola and Ornette Coleman.
Oh.
And it's simply because there's an ascending line in Amanette that reminds me of a song by Scott Amendola called Street Beat that he dedicated to Ed Blackwell years and years ago. It's a really good little fast bop-influenced line. And then the other lines remind me of Ornette. And the strategies involved with playing the song are a little bit Ornette-like. And certainly Ornette Coleman's a huge inspiration to me on many levels. Well, so is Scott Amendola, for that matter.
Sure. The way the release opens, though, that, I was like, I don't know if that was intentional that that was placed there or what, but it was like, boom, we're here. amazing. A Furtive, yes.
I have to say, I wasn't going to start the record with that song. That song was written and recorded without ever having played it live. I wrote two new pieces that we got together and recorded to flesh out the record. We had one day when everyone could be in the same place, so I just took the day and said, here, let's try this. And it was Julian who suggested that I open with it, and at least that I think about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I liked it. And certainly starting a record with not only a big polychord, but a Tom Rainey drum solo is pretty badass, I guess, from my standpoint it is.
Mm-hmm.
So now I really like that, and I'm glad that it had a little impact on you there.
Oh, yeah.
That song is kind of inspired by the Duke Ellington piece from Far East Week called A Tourist Point of View.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody else will think of that, but that's how I sort of think about it.
Hmm. Tell us about Tom Rainey.
Oh, Tom and I started playing together maybe about 18 or 19 years ago. He's just somebody that I was aware of from all his work. Well, everyone in the Niles Klein Four is originally from California, which is something I didn't realize until I started the band.
Wow.
But Tom's from Santa Barbara, and I remember him and hearing his name when he moved to New York 100 years ago, and he played with a lot of people like Fred Hirsch for a long time and Kenny Werner, and just really doing a million gigs, but always really, really inventive, and somebody who could play, you know, as we might say, straight ahead, but who, as he's gotten older, or maybe he always felt this way, but he's definitely dedicated to improvisation and to really open playing, yet he has this amazing vocabulary of, you know, what I might call the jazz master. And I also think he's one of the most kind of overlooked and underrated guys right now in New York, maybe just because he's been around for a while, but I think also because he's really gone into a lot more free playing, and his stuff with Tony Malaby and Angie Sanchez, that trio is one of my favorites. His duo is with his wife, Ingrid Wildbrock, who's an amazing tenor saxophone player. So Tom's really one of my favorite musicians. And when Julie and I were pondering a rhythm section, Julian didn't know Tom, and Scott really wanted to start doing some playing with me, and certainly Julian and Scott Colley go way back to years with Gary Burton's New Quartet, and Scott plays in Julian's trio when schedulable, and we just had to get Scott. I mean, that was sort of an obvious choice, I suppose.
Wow.
I can't believe I get to play with these guys.
Ingrid Laubrock, now that you mentioned her, she I know of from Arts for Arts Vision Festival. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am, but I have not participated in
No.
that. But yeah, but she gets around.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
She is. I also have heard her playing with Mary Halverson, the guitarist, who
plays
with
Mark Rebo.
Yes,
her octet.
Yes.
With Chris Whitecap and Thomas Fujiwara. Those guys are amazing.
Yes.
Susan Alcorn.
Yes.
Amazing pedal steel player.
Yes.
Yeah, well, Mary's one of my favorite artists for sure.
When I see these guitar gatherings that you participate in, I've seen Mark Rebo there. I've seen other guitarists, you know, like Bill Frisell. I don't see Mary Halverson in these gatherings. Did I just miss that happening? Will it be happening again?
Well, certainly I've played with Mary on and off. Yeah, actually last summer did a 6 resonator guitar ensemble that included Mary.
Okay.
She and I played duo. I've also played in a trio setting with her and Chess Smith, but that was many years ago. We played together on some of the improv nights at the Stone just recently.
Okay.
I love playing with Mary. I first heard Mary, probably about 18 years ago or so, when Chess Smith, who was at the time living in Northern California, played me a cassette that had a track with Mary playing on it. He said, you should hear this guitarist. And then it wasn't not long after that Trevor Dunn formed Trio Convulsant with Chess and Mary. And that was the first time I saw Mary play live. It's actually in Chicago on a Fantomas tour that they were part of. And I've been a fan of Mary's ever since.
Yay.
I love playing with all the guitarists that you've mentioned. It's kind of amazing. I think guitarists really like playing together. I've played with a lot of them. With Rebo, and we like playing together a lot too.
Do you have any other plans to get
with Mark?
Yeah,
I never know.
Okay.
And I think the last time he and I played together was during one of my weeks at the Stone, and we played acoustic duets, completely improvised.
Wow.
Which we've done also in Austria at Saalfelden one year, and we did a quartet with Bill Frisell, Mark, me, and Shahzada Smiley at Le Poisson Rouge one night. So you never know; they seem to come up out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
These gigs.
Wow. I noticed that Chez also plays with Mark. It's like this community.
Ceramic Dog.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Chez has been playing, Chez and Shahzad,
mm-hmm.
with Mark as Ceramic Dog now for years.
Right.
They have a really nice long run going.
Right.
And a brand new record.
Ah, well, I didn't know about the brand new record. You know, there's always something coming up. There's always a new something that people are
yeah.
recording.
I don't know if it's actually out yet, but it's
okay.
out this month, I'm pretty
okay.
sure. Yeah.
As far as recording, now, we were talking about your being on Blue Note and having that opportunity. How important is it for you to record, to have a recording?
That's a really interesting question, because I think my thoughts about it tend to vary greatly. I think we all love recording
right.
because we all grew up on recorded music. And
right.
I think that it's interesting now that recorded music is, of course, far more available since basically everyone just figures out how to get it for free. And people will say they can't live without, quote unquote, their music. And I guess I'm one of those people in a way. I mean, I grew up listening to records and collecting records. And, well, I wouldn't say collecting. I'd say acquiring records. I worked in a record store for 10 years in West Los Angeles in the late 70s to mid 80s. And so recordings are fascinating, compelling. Sometimes they're the objects of obsession, certainly great scrutiny. As far as doing my own recordings, I'm kind of astonished when I look back at certain decisions that I made on my own records, wondering what the heck I was thinking. But it's really fun to record something that you end up liking to listen to, you know. But a lot of times that's not the case with me, so I end up frustrated. And I really have kind of moved on to the next recording in my head before the one that's about to be finished is finished, you know. I sometimes just want to move away and just go to a whole new thing rather than slave over it sort of obsessively for months or years, as some people do, crafting what might be the perfect record. But since I don't believe in that, since I am an improviser, I kind of leave it everything in the warts and all state. And
yes.
sometimes people find freshness in that, and other times I'm sure that they're embarrassed for me. But that's sort of how I do it. So it's fun, and it's frustrating, and it's kind of, I guess, rather a paradox for the improviser to have this sort of frozen, ossified document that stands for really just a few minutes in time, as long as we have electricity to listen to it.
Right.
You know? So it's because it's not a symphonic work and it's not a movie soundtrack. It's just a postcard from a little excursion, you know?
I understand that you listen to your recordings. You have listened to
your
recordings.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I go in phases about things like that. There are only certain records of mine that I actually listen to. And then every once in a while, I'll dig up one of my older records and then confronted after years. I'm not sure why I like certain records of mine more than others, but I think it's maybe because they had a unified purpose for me sonically or conceptually that allows me to revisit them without overanalyzing or overcriticizing my playing. You know, the whole thing about playing and soloing to me sometimes is quite a burden. And sometimes I am distrustful of the soloist or the solo. And that's usually where a lot of my dissatisfaction comes. Listening to myself is when I'm so-called blowing, trying to play a fascinating and exciting solo of some sort. And when I'm listening with satisfaction, it's generally maybe because of the writing. I enjoyed hearing what I wrote. It sounds good to me still, or there's some kind of an ensemble thing that happened that blew my mind that got captured on tape or zeros and ones. And that part of it's really satisfying. But if there's a whole lot of guitar soloing on it, I probably am not listening to that record.
Thank you.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar Give My Bowls the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is guitarist, composer, Nels Klein. I hate to interrupt this selection, but what you're listening to right now is Blue Particles from Nels Klein and Elliot Sharp. Their 2012 Public Eyesore Records release, Open the Door. Nels Klein on acoustic guitar and Elliot Sharp is also on acoustic guitar. I'm interrupting now because there is not a lot of time at the end of the show, and so I'm going to squeeze in information right now. Furtive is what we heard before that from the current Nels Klein 4 release, Currents Constellations, on Blue Note Records, which features Nels Klein on acoustic guitar and electric guitar, Julian Lage on electric guitar, Scott Colley on acoustic bass, and Tom Rainey on drums. Before that, we heard another selection from Currents Constellations, Aminette. Before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and Nels Klein right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Elliot Sharp, another guitarist. You did a duet with him.
Yeah, we've done a couple of duet records. Uh-huh. I love Elliot. Elliot's one of my favorite people on the whole planet.
What brought you together to work on the projects? Just being around?
Elliot, I'm trying to remember how I met Elliot. It was probably at Tonic. Maybe I went to go hear him at Tonic, and we started chatting. But Elliot was one of the first, if not the first, really welcoming guitar god of New York to me and others. Elliot's always been really nice to people and helpful to people who are visiting New York and don't necessarily know their way around the town or something. I don't know. He was just really cool. And, you know, I'd been listening to Elliot for a long time. Some of these people that are fixtures in the New York world, I met through my brother Alex when they were just starting out, and that would be somebody like Tim Byrne, who, when we met Tim, was Julius Hemphill's sort of assistant and really good friend. But somebody like Elliot, I think I just met at Tonic or someplace as a listener and fan, and we became friends very quickly, and sometimes I would stay in his studio when I needed a place to stay, and he's always been really, really cool. But also, playing together brings out a different sort of style in me, and I think much like playing with Mark Rebo, I really like playing with Elliot acoustic, two acoustic guitars. That's sort of my favorite thing with both Elliot and with Mr. Rebo, for some personal reasons, I guess. I mean, aesthetic reasons that are purely subjective. But also, Elliot's a super underrated guitar player. A lot of people, I think, either don't listen to him as a guitar player and they think of him as a composer primarily, or I don't know, they're just not paying attention. His solo recording of Thelonious Monk songs is one of the most incredible, and it's really profound how he completely dismantled everything about a Monk composition and guitar and reassembled it in this amazing form. But it's pretty out there, so I don't know if it's for everybody, but he's amazing.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl is the name of this program. Our guest for this evening is Nels Klein. What you're listening to in the background is McNeil Island Pumpkin from Nels Klein's 2006 Cryptogramophone Records release, New Monastery, A View into the Music of Andrew Hill. Andrew Hill is the composer. Nels Klein, guitar and effects, Bobby Bradford on cornet, Scott Amendola on drums and percussion, Ben Goldberg on clarinet, Devin Hoff on contrabass, and Alex Klein on percussion on other selections. We'll be hearing an excerpt from Under a Void Moon from Whiteout with Nels Klein from Accidental Sky. I really hate talking over this. Whiteout with Nels Klein has Tom Sergal on drums and percussion, Lynn Culbertson on analog synth and auto harp and voice, and Nels Klein on guitar and effects. Stay tuned.
You mentioned Elliot Sharp doing the Thelonious Monk focus. You did a new monastery, a view into the music of Andrew Hill. What was it about Andrew Hill's music that made you want to recognize?
Oh, I love talking about this. Thank you for asking. This was sort of around the time that I was newly in Wilco. And as I mentioned, suddenly there was a lot of attention on me, and I was not particularly comfortable with the amount of attention and sort of scrutiny. I was just trying to get used to it, and I just thought that I could do something with it that would sort of divert attention from me. And I wanted to point the finger at somebody I thought maybe people should check out, who was underappreciated, but who had a legacy of composition and improvisation that I have found to be profound, and somebody who's not a guitar player. And I think Andrew Hill certainly fits the bill, having loved his records and been fascinated by him as a composer and pianist. I just sort of, without giving it hours and hours or days and months of thought, I just thought, Andrew, let's like this, do a record of Andrew Hill stuff, and assembled a group to do it. And it was really, really fun. And it turned out that Andrew himself actually liked the record.
Wow.
Yeah. I actually only recently met his widow, who was super lovely. I didn't know that he was ill when I came up with the idea of doing the record. And so trying to get it together, and at this point, Bruce Lundvall was really, really helpful in getting me permission to use his eye inside the sunglass from the cover of Pointed Departure. We got permission. I got a lot of music from Blue Note and Mosaic to increase my awareness of that oeuvre. And I just started picking songs. It was really, I think, satisfying on the conceptual level that I intended it to be, which was to do the music of another artist. And possibly, maybe, a few Wilco fans decided to check out some Andrew Hill records.
Yeah.
Would have been part of my goal.
Nice. I'm glad you did it. I gotta say that.
Thank you. It also gave me a chance to get together and play some music on one of my own records with one of my really kind of first inspirations on a direct sort of mentor level in Los Angeles, was Bobby Bradford, the cornet player.
Ah.
He and his musical partner, John Carter, were tremendously important to me and to my brother and to our friends in Los Angeles. And I played along with Vinny Golia and my brother Alex and Roberto Miranda in Bobby's group for a while before I moved and before I went on tour forever. It was just really a great chance to play with Bobby, and we even did a few gigs playing that music. Even in New York, we played the Jazz Standard and did that music. It was the same week that Andrew did his last concert in New York, the trio concert down at Battery Park in that church. I couldn't go because I was at Columbia University shilling for my concert on the radio.
Wow.
It was really sad.
Oh, at
Andrew
WKCR.
Didn't live much longer. Yes, right.
Oh, wow.
Oops.
Mm.
Oh, well.
Well, I'm glad you put that work into your discography, that
Thank
it exists.
Thank you so much. I have to say, one of the weirdest things about making that record was having people say to me, but there's no piano. And I thought, well, the whole point of the record, besides pointing a finger at this man, Andrew Hill, was to make a statement that music by such composers as, whether it's Andrew Hill or Bobby Hutcherson or Eric Dolphy or Charles Mingus, that a lot of these people not only don't get their music played at all, or there's only one or two compositions, say, by Charles Mingus that anyone plays, but they should be able to be played by other instruments other than what was on the recording session. You
That's
know what I mean?
Right.
That's the whole point. That's, you know, I don't know if anybody, when they started hearing someone improvise on a Tin Pan Alley song, said, hey, where are the vocals? It's like, this is material to be interpreted and reinterpreted, in my opinion. So anyway, that was kind of part of the deal. New Monastery.
There's a recording that you made. Please explain it. Well, I don't mean explain it because, you know, it's like, this is so unusual. You're going to have to explain what was going on here. But what I'm saying, it's just so amazing. I love it. Whiteout. This project, Whiteout with Nels Cline. Accidental
Sky. Yes, on Northern Spy.
Yeah.
Whiteout is a duo, an improvising duo, and it's two friends of mine that I've collaborated with on and off, for maybe about 18 years now, or 17 years. So it's Lynn Culbertson on analog synthesizer and electric auto harp and voice and flute, and Tom Sergal on drums and percussion.
Yes.
And they play, you know, free improvised music. It's kind of a certain kind of free jazz that really reminds me at times of maybe Sun Ra heliocentric worlds type of stuff. And that's just not the kind of thing that I often hear when I go hear improvised music. I'm very rarely reminded of Sun Ra heliocentric worlds or anything like that. And I met Tom Sergal first through Thurston Moore. He and Thurston Moore had a duo that played at a concert series I used to book on Monday nights in Santa Monica, California. And then when I came to New York to play, Tom would be around, and eventually we played together at Tonic and collaborated on and off for years, and in fact even toured Europe together. Boy, that was a long time ago too. Europe and the UK, and finally recorded. There's a live record that never came out, but we recorded Accidental Sky in Tom and Lynn's apartment, and Tom and his engineer friend mixed it, and I guess maybe did some editing, and there it is. And it's got that kind of futuristic but organic, it sounds like music of Earth and the heavens all at the same time. And I guess in a way it's a kind of a throwback. You know, Tom's really coming out of the Paul Ovens, Beaver Harris, Sonny Murray school of drumming, whatever that means. But I guess that means free.
Exactly.
But free with knowledge or awareness. You don't hear a lot of people as into that music now as he is. He's also been working for years now on a documentary about free jazz with a bunch of interviews, and called Fire Music.
Yeah.
Free Jazz Revolution.
Yes! I knew the name sounded familiar. I just received an email from them. I was part of the Kickstarter contributors. And
God, it's taking forever to finish.
Yes.
The editor is so busy.
Well, they say that they're going to be making a special announcement soon. It's like, okay. But they're moving forward, which is good.
Oh, glad to hear it. Well, also, it's nice that they've appropriated the title of an Archie Shepp record, and
yes,
maybe people will start thinking about Archie Shepp, too. Because, boy, oh, boy, there's an incredible artist that doesn't get discussed much, I think, unless you went to school and had him as a teacher in Massachusetts or wherever he teaches or taught. But that's some amazing music right there.
He was here earlier this year as part of a panel during the Winter Jazz Festival, moderated by a buddy, Ross Burnett Moshe. They were talking about politics and music, but
right,
he's going to be back for the Vision Festival in May, at the end of May, as part of a tribute to Dave Burrell, the pianist.
Oh, wow, cool.
So if you want to see him, that's where he'll be.
Oh, very good.
The Whiteout release, well, I suspect, and generally with your playing, there were pedals involved. I suspect there were pedals involved here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I had, I think, my full psych ward going there. It was, the whole pedal thing, I guess I'll have to address it now.
Yes.
Because you mentioned them.
Yes.
You know, when I started out playing as a kid, I had a fuzz box, and eventually I had a wah-wah pedal. But I didn't know how to play at all, and basically just did a lot of feedback and fast trills and blew up my little amp. And then I took another path in life and then played with no effects at all the way up until maybe my college years. And it was when my friend Vinnie Golia left an Echoplex in my room, and I started improvising with a college friend named Brian and my brother Alex, and started making space noises, that I started maybe thinking about getting a couple of pedals. So the rest, I guess, is history. I never really intended to be some sort of crazed pedal person, but I think that they suit my desire to create sounds and to imagine sounds and then create sounds based on a combination of what I heard coming out of recording studios in the 60s and 70s, which is to say just studio effects that used to not be possible to do live, such as various kinds of delays and flanging and whatever, phase shifting, that I associate with my man Hendrix, Jimi Hendrix, and others as well. And then also the possibility of changing the sound of the guitar completely with a harmonizer, with massive distortion, or both, or with objects on the guitar, things where I got maybe inspired by Fred Frith in the 70s, and Derek Bailey, and Keith Rowe, and people like that. But essentially, without copying their thing, what I was really trying to do is just, I guess, expand the expressive capabilities of the instrument. And when I realized that this was something that wasn't hard for me, I don't want to sound like an idiot. It's something I know how to do. It's just something that comes naturally to me. And so it's become an object of great interest and possible overt and over-obsession scrutiny to me, it's not inherently interesting. What's interesting is what people do with whatever they like to use.
Right.
You know, it doesn't really matter to me whether people use pedals or not, or whether it's electric or acoustic. But certainly when playing with somebody like Whiteout, I can imagine my role to be a sonic one, and it's not incumbent upon me to play some sort of inventive melodic content or wonder how to put inventive melodic content into their style of improvising. Instead, I can participate in pure sound and sound making. And in this way, I guess, expanded the vocabulary of the electric guitar. But that's easy to do. The electric guitar is very flexible, malleable. It's easy to mess with.
Right.
And that's part of the fun of it. And also, maybe besides popular music, why it's sort of ubiquitous in our culture. It just fits into a lot of places. And I guess that explains my sort of polymath sensibility as well. It's just something about the electric guitar particularly just seems to fit into a lot of different areas. And I seem to be able to imagine some of those sonic possibilities and try to do them. So with Whiteout, I sound sort of like, I guess, some sort of weird synthesizer player at the time.
Right, right. But it's cool, though. Now, there's one thing. There are two more questions I want to ask you before, because we've been chatting a bit, and I'm grateful for this time. One
sure.
being, in playing various guitars, what is it that you're looking for in a guitar? Because I know Pat Metheny's got this customized 42-string custom-made guitar that's really nice. It comes out for the selection, and the roadie takes it back when he's done. And Bill Frisell has like a closet full of guitars. So what is it that you're looking for when you buy guitars?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it does bring up something I share with Bill, which is a certain degree of embarrassment verging on guilt for having quite a lot of guitars that I've acquired over the years, certainly post-Wilco. But what I'm looking for specifically can be boiled down to just a handful of things. For me, there's obviously the feel of an instrument is important, but it's not as important as a certain function of flexibility sound-wise. In other words, you have some tone knobs and switches and a couple of pickups, so you can get a few different sounds that you like, okay? But the other thing that's most crucial, if I'm going to play one electric guitar, is to have some string lengths behind the bridge, because I like to play the notes behind the bridge and above the nut and try to bring out a lot of these idiomatic sounds, which I think have, besides sonic interest, they can also enhance the expressive power by adding these sort of ripping and more bracing, or should I say abrasive, musical textures. A lot of my inspiration to use Fender Jazzmaster and Jaguar guitars came from listening to Sonic Youth and what Lee Rinaldo and Kirsten Moore do with their guitars. That's why I've settled on primarily playing Fender Jazzmasters, although I have many other guitars. So why have many other guitars? Because, for example, when I play with Julian Lage, I play what is essentially a kind of jazz guitar, meaning a hollow body guitar with hum-canceling pickups. I play quietly. Feeding back isn't a problem because I'm playing so quietly. The feel of the guitar is completely different, and it kind of makes me play differently in that sense. Other guitars I buy because of weird retro tones that one can get out of them. And these guitars are more sort of objects of fascination for recording, possibly for gigging, but they're not particularly versatile, and they're really cool looking, and they're not expensive.
Wow.
So sometimes I get really into these weird, needly, nasal, retro 60s tones, these cheap guitars, and that can be a disease. And then there's the world of acoustic guitars, and in the case of, you mentioned Pat Metheny, he has that guitar that Linda Manzer made with all the necks coming off of it that looks like Picasso created it or
right.
something. And that thing sounds amazing.
It does.
I've never purchased a guitar that's probably even close to how much any Linda Manzer guitar costs. So I basically kind of have heaps of not very expensive guitars, except for a couple. And the rest of it's just my disease. It's just that I have them because they call to me and I can write them off on my income tax.
Okay.
And I love them. You know, that's the thing. It's like, you know, traveling with Wilco, we travel with a lot of guitars, and I have a lot of guitars, and I can change guitars for tone, change guitars for register. I love playing 12-string, so I always have 12-string involved with my music. And I look at my stuff at soundcheck, guitars in the vault sitting there aside stage, and every day I see that stuff, and I just think, oh, I love those guitars.
Mm. Wow.
I just do.
When did you come to New York, and what brought you here?
Well, it's interesting. What brought me here was falling in love with my wife, to move. But I first thought of moving to New York in 1976, so it definitely took me a while. I just love New York. I have since I was a young person. I first came here with my family in 1967, and then the following summer in 1968. And then my brother Alex and I came on a, you might call it a loft jazz or jazz pilgrimage in 1976. Stayed with a family friend in the West Village and went to hear everything that we could hear in a week.
Wow.
I mean, I remember we heard a lot of music. The first thing we did was drop our luggage and go hear Air at the Tin Palace. And then we went to the Herbie Hancock retrospective as part of Newport in New York, and the tribute to John Coltrane with McCoy Tyner's band and Elvin Jones' band. And we went to go hear Oliver Lake David Murray Duo and jam sessions at Stanley Crouch's Studio Infinity. And we went to Boomers and heard Eddie Henderson playing with Kirk Lightsey. And
wow.
I can't remember if it was Michael Carvin. I can't remember who all was playing. Maybe John Stubblefield. We heard a lot of music, and that was when I first thought that, you know, New York would be maybe a good place for me. I think, truthfully, I would have been chewed up and spit out and destroyed by New York, because my skill set is definitely not at the level of most New Yorkers.
Oh, my goodness.
But I started coming here a lot, even the mid and late 80s, and did some playing with Tim Byrne and just hanging out in his loft, recording a little at the Knitting Factory with Mark Dresser and Mark Feldman. And so things were just sort of gradually building, I suppose. But it was when I met my wife, Yuka Honda, and Mike Watt and Dougie Bowne and I made a record in 2009 called Floored by Four that Mike Watt instigated. And that is when Yuka and I sort of, without knowing it, fell in love and blah, blah, blah. The rest is history. So I moved finally. So it's been about 9 years now.
Wow.
I didn't move all my stuff 9 years ago. My stuff sort of stayed in Glendale, California for a long time, but I just lived here and let people stay in my place for years.
You were here during that period in the 80s and 90s when music was just amazing in this town. I mean, I guess, you know, 70s as well.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used to love the old Knitting Factory on Houston.
Yes.
I played there with my old trio on a bill with Tim Burns Blood Count. And they played acoustically on the floor, and my trio played very electrically on the stage.
Wow.
And at this point, you know, I remember borrowing Thurston Moore's amp, and Sonic Youth were at Mott Street Space. That's where they had their practice room, and just wheeling the amp down Mott Street around the corner to the Knitting Factory.
Wow.
This massive PV amp. And that was when I was seeing maybe my first inkling of cross-pollinization between the so-called downtown scene and a lot of these, I guess you'd call them rock-type people, you know? I mean,
right.
The improvisers' aesthetic, the composer's aesthetic, and the sort of punk aesthetic starting to kind of merge in a social way, I guess, maybe first, and then musically, ultimately. And for me, this was hugely satisfying as somebody, as I described myself before, not really possessing a tradition per se, and being regarded with considerable suspicion by the music press in the 70s when I was playing with Julius Hemphill. Well, that was the 80s, but Vinnie Golia, Tim Byrne, and playing non-tasty jazz guitar. They'd asked me to play psychedelic guitar solos and blues solos, and that didn't go over so well. But that was changing in the 80s, so things were starting to become a little bit more holistic. And that was a lot to me. I was really into Sonic Youth in the 80s and feeling a lot of inspiration to explore guitar in a different way from having listened to them. And at the same time, I was playing in California with Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra, West Coast, playing nylon string guitar with one of my absolute heroes, Charlie Hayden. And so my life was really interesting, doing all these cool things. But I always had a day job. I was always working in retail, like book and record store job, for about 18 years.
Wow. I'm glad you mentioned Charlie Hayden. There was a selection that you did in honor of Charlie Hayden on one of your recordings. And I was wondering what your connection was. It's Scott Colley was involved with, or he studied or something.
It's amazing how many musicians I ended up playing with because I worked in a record store. And one of them is Charlie Hayden. Charlie had come into Rhino Records, where I used to work in West Los Angeles. And he met my friend Lee Kaplan. And Lee would quite often, within minutes, tell these people, like, you need to play with my friends Nelson Alex. And so In this case, Charlie, I think, might have said that he was looking for a nylon string guitar player, and Lee recommended that he call me, and he did. And Charlie and I started playing rather informally. At first, I would just play Song for Che with him. He was playing duets with Bobby Bradford, and I would come up and just play Song for Che for 20 minutes or something.
Wow.
And Charlie was always incredibly nice to me. I was in my early 20s, mid-20s, you know, non-union, guy worked in a record store. And he and I had some really good improvising times together, in spite of the fact that playing bebop or playing Freddie Green comping, which sometimes he wanted me to do, was not in my wheelhouse. But when it came to free playing and just getting to that sort of free harmonic zone, man, that was heaven playing with him. So he would just always hire me for those gigs. It only lasted about 4 years until he made Liberation Music Orchestra West Coast sort of a CalArts student ensemble, and he started teaching there. But Scott Colley's from Eagle Rock, California. That's sort of, it's Los Angeles City, but it's sort of the northeasternmost part of Los Angeles, and I ended up living there. Well, I went to school there briefly in the 70s at Occidental College, and then ended up living there from about 1999 until 2006 or something. Love Eagle Rock, but he's a total L.A. dude.
Hmm.
Charlie had started living in Los Angeles to be near his ex-wife Ellen and his kids.
Uh-huh.
So he was living in West Los Angeles in the Brentwood area, really close to where I was living in Santa Monica for years.
Wonderful. There does indeed need to be a film about New York in the mid-70s through 95. That's my feeling anyway, mm-hmm. 95 in particular, because there was so much going on in New York at that time. And this film in my, you know, I know it, I hear it, I can see it. It would include you, it would include Bill Frisell, Mark Rebo, Vernon Reed. It's like there's, you know, so many, you know, Melvin Gibbs. There's so many people.
Yes. Well, so... It's so interesting that one of the things that happened when I started living here and I got together with Yuka is I ended up playing with a bunch of her old neighbors that she was hoping I would eventually play with. For example, I had never played with Mark Rebo before, and she was obsessed with Mark and me getting together at some point. I ended up recording and touring with her old neighbors, Modesky, Martin, and Woods, certainly playing Weeks at the Stone for John Zorn, and being on her old street without knowing it when I would stay in Ellie Sharp's studio on 7th Street and would run into Butch Morris on the street and Charles Gayle. And it was super fun for me. I'm finally here.
Yes. Well, glad you're here, and we will see you tomorrow at Le Poisson Rouge, 8 p.m., Nels Klein 4, or the NC4, featuring Julian Lage, Scott Colley, and Tom Rainey, and our guest this evening, Nels Klein. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joyce. And we also have the amazing Marika Hughes opening for us. Yeah.
Cellist, Marika Hughes.
Bryce, at the last minute, wanted an opener, and Marika's going to play duo with a bass player whose name escapes me right now, and I'm sorry. But yeah, I'm very excited about Marika. Somebody's last name is Carter, and it sounds, I want to say Jamal Carter.
Rasan Carter. Oh my gosh, yay!
Somebody I don't know.
You'll enjoy it, believe me. He has a brother named Sean who plays drums.
Oh, crazy.
And they actually play together with David Murray, among other people.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
David, I first heard when he was a student at Pomona College, and he was just obviously going to go places. He and James Newton were students at Pomona College and played in Stanley Crouch's Black Music Infinity.
Yes!
Oh, I heard two or three times, I guess, with Mark Dresser and Bobby Bradford in the band. That's when Stanley had a different idea about free jazz than he does now.
Yes, exactly. And when he was playing at somebody, I'm quoting someone who said that Stanley was playing at the drums. Well, thank you so much, Nels Klein. I really appreciate this time that you spent.
Thank you, Joyce.
See you on Monday.
Thanks for the support. Bye.
Another selection from Currents and Constellations, Swing Ghost 59. Sugar in My Bowl will be back on April 29th. Many thanks to Nels Klein. La Nueva Alternativa is scheduled next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello.
Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.